The immensity and wonder of the night sky has given rise to myth, philosophical musings, and fiction for millennia. You might remember from your childhood the story of the Little Prince, a small boy from another star who arrives on this planet and questions all he encounters. Then there's the moon landing, the recent discovery of another ring around Saturn, and the endless fascination with the possibilities of life on other planets. But what is it that draws the amateur astronomer? It can be a cold and lonely, all-consuming pursuit. Yet there are thousands of them across the country spending their nights searching that immensity. Are they responding to fact or fantasy, philosophical speculation or something else? Producer Nicole Steinke set out to find out what sort of person would be an amateur astronomer and why.
Oh, now this is a beautiful clear sky tonight.
Yep. We've got Venus as the bright star in the west, and above that and to the left is Mars. And then over here we've got the Moon and Jupiter next to that.
Do any of those have any interest to you?
Sure, they're the planets. They're our neighbourhood. They're part of our backyard, as it were. I think about them all the time, where they are in the sky. I know which ones setting, when they're rising. I like to observe the moons of, for example, Jupiter. They go in a cycle. When Saturn's up, of course, you almost always look at the rings.
What? You drop down from the sky? Yes, I answered modestly. Oh, that is funny. And the little prince broke into a lovely peal of laughter, which irritated me very much. I like my misfortunes to be taken seriously. Then he added, "So you come from the sky too. Which is your planet?"
This is my dog Tilly demanding detention. Hello, sweetheart. Hello, yes, yes. I missed you too. Yep. Okay, down. I have to rouse. Yeah, so Saturn is unique, at least unique in the solar system. So it's always a special sight.
Are there a lot of different little groups all over, well, not just Sydney, but Australia?
All over Australia and all over the world. There's small astronomy groups, might be 10 or 15 people that might meet once a month. But with the internet, that's developed a whole new genre, I suppose the word, of like-minded people who can meet online. If you're interested in one particular type of object or observations or some sort of niche, you can meet up with people in Brazil. The sort of astronomy that I'm interested in, and that's occultations. I have 20 or 30 friends I've never met other than online all over the world. We help each other out with advice on equipment and techniques. So there's a real online community.
So not only do you go off to the shed,
yeah,
roll back the roof so that you have your observatory here in the foothills of the Blue Mountains, and your family loses you then, they also lose you online.
Oh, yes, I suppose so. But the other side of the coin is I'm a home guy, and if I'm needed, I'm only an oi away. Watching television is not my bag, but I'm usually busy doing something to do with astronomy while I'm at home. I'm always thinking about astronomy, thinking about some new piece of equipment I want to make or modify. And if I'm needed with homework, they come out to the sky shed and say, "Dad, you know." So I'm not away from home. I'm a home guy.
I'd learned a second fact of great importance. The planet the little prince came from was hardly any larger than a house. I have reason to believe the planet the Little Prince came from is the asteroid known as B612.
I remember that it was heading north very quickly. It was going to be a northern hemisphere object. And it was developing a long tail, and the weather was very iffy. And so we jumped in the car and we drove. And we ended up going up the Putty Road towards Singleton. I remember to this day going around a bend in the road, and in front of it was like a hill. And the object was about to go below the height of the hill, but it was just this beacon shining straight up in the sky. And I must admit, I nearly drove off the road. Haya Kotake was a brilliant comet. In fact, it was your classic searchlight comet. You know, like, a lot of comets can be just a fuzzy ball in the sky, but this had a really long, convoluted tail. And, in fact, I remember at the time a lot of people ringing me up, friends, saying, wow, I found a comet last night. And you feel like saying to them, well, you don't realise how rare that is. You know, to actually go out and visually discover, independently discover a comet, just because somebody else found it a month earlier.
When a comet is found, and it's credited to me, it would have the name Bradfield, and it would have a date associated with that. So it goes in the catalogue as Comet Bradfield, so-and-so and so-and-so. That's a permanent record.
What is the feeling when you actually see something out there?
Well, if you see one, you get a certain amount of excitement straight away, and you look at the star charts and you say, gee, there's no fuzz on the star chart. Okay, all the things that do look fuzzies are marked on the star charts. They're permanent. They're there from right the beginnings of life to forever. But if you see something that's not on the star chart, I mean, that's the indication that it's a comet, then you say to yourself, now, is this comet something that's been known about for the last fortnight and I've only just found out? Well, okay, that sometimes happens. Sometimes comets are found quite unexpectedly. There might be bad weather all around the world and nobody finds any comets because the sky hasn't been accessible. And then suddenly they get a spot of clear sky. And, oh, yeah, there's a comet low in the western sky. Just went down after sunset. Gee, it had a big tail. You know, they sort of pop out of nowhere. And people get excitement. Well, I got a lot of excitement when suddenly I discovered a comet with a tail. If I went out tomorrow night and found a comet, I'd be making whoopee because I haven't found one for about 4 or 5 years. The last comet I found was in 2004.
Wait, turn that around.
Okay. Excuse me, you can't bump the telescope. So just step back a metre or so, give some space and make a queue right over at the fence.
Oh, that's amazing. Look at that.
I bought a new laser pointer the other day. It was really one of these bright illegal ones. And I said, I was pointing it at stars and giving them signals. Beep, beep, beep. I say, okay, I'm sending signals to the extraterrestrials. So I had my own little let's contact the extraterrestrials instrument going on. But that's just a joke.
So nobody spoke back.
Well, you wouldn't expect it, right? These stars are 5, 10, 100 light years away. And if they spoke back, it would be in about 200 years and I'd be dead.
There's a star called Antares. I like to know anything that's happening with Antares. It's the brightest star in Scorpius, and it's a huge red giant star. So I always know where Antares is at any given moment. Another one that's of special interest to me is a star called Alpha Centaurus. Alpha Centaurus is just over there behind the trees, but it's the closest star to us other than our sun. And when people view it through the telescope, they see two stars. So when they look at it with the naked eye, they see one. When they look in the telescope, they say, oh, there's two. And to try and give people a scale of the universe, I say the fastest thing mankind can travel in at the moment is the space shuttle. That gets up to maybe 12 kilometres per second as it orbits the Earth. So if we were going to zoom off to Alpha Centaurus, it'd take us 32,000 years to get there in the space shuttle. So you'd need to take your packed lunch.
I'm very fond of sunsets. Come on, let's go look at a sunset now. But we have to wait, I said. Wait? For what? For the sunset. We must wait until it's the right time. At first you seemed very surprised. One day on my planet, you said to me, I saw the sunset 44 times.
For the mankind to travel through the stars, they have to come up with some sort of physics that we've got no understanding of at the moment. We're stuck on this planet Earth, whether we like it or not. 100 years' time, mankind might visit one of the moons of Jupiter or something like that.
Are you down to go to Mars?
No, not me. It's too cold. Too cold. Not enough atmosphere. I'm fine here. I like my Blue Mountains. Thanks very much.
Now, what have you done?
You've destroyed the moon.
Keep going.
Can you see it? Can you see at least a bit of it?
Ben, can I have a try?
What do you think is the difference between an amateur and a professional astronomer?
Well, last month I was invited to be the professional astronomer who gave a lecture to the South Pacific Star Party. I drove up there, and this site was middle of nowhere, and it was raining, and it had been cloudy for days and days. And so here's a group of 200, 300 astronomers from all over Australia who got together with their utes and their telescopes. Most of them are hand-built, and these guys were so into their little instruments. And here I was, somebody who doesn't know the stars. For example, one difference between an amateur astronomer and a professional is if you go out with an amateur astronomer and say, hey, what's the name of that star? They'll tell you instantly. If you go out with a professional astronomer and say, what's that star? They'll usually say, hey, I'm not a Boy Scout. So astronomers are a little bit arrogant like this because they know the coordinates of these stars and they know how this star compares to the other stars. They know astrophysics. They know about hydrogen and balls of gas and the evolution of stars and big picture stuff. But they don't necessarily know the map of constellations above their heads. The amateur astronomers are passionate about staying up all night in the freezing cold and looking at these stars. It's a weird combination of loneliness and hypothermia.
My first comet was discovered in 1972 in the morning sky from the backyard of my place, and since then I've discovered another 17 comets, so that 18 in total. It has been my practice to travel out in the country to get away from the city lights. And I've been going further and further and further out over the years. And, of course, this has used up a lot of petrol money for my running my car. And I'm still hopeful for finding the 19th one.
A dream in my heart, without a love of my own. You knew just what I was there for. You heard me whisper a prayer for someone I really could care for.
Are you married?
Yes.
How long have you been married?
Oh, got married in 1957, so that's, 40 years plus.
What does your wife think of this ongoing obsession?
Well, she's accepted it over the years, and of course she would be aware in those early years that suddenly she'd sort of feel out and that my body wasn't next to the, you know, and I'd gone out. I used to park my telescope well away from a main road to avoid lights from cars, but then invariably you'd find that you're on a nice quiet spot and a car would come down the road and they would slow down. They would wonder what this mysterious thing is, this person with some funny gadget parked on the side of the road, and they might say, "Oh, what you doing, mate?" Then you'd have some people who would say, "Oh, can I have a look?" And of course, as far as I'm concerned, I wasn't there to sort of show people the stars through my telescope, and so I was hopeful that they wouldn't pursue that request and hop in their car and drive away.
See the craters on the side?
Yep, you can see across.
Yeah, it's quite small.
Is it red?
Yeah.
And there's an actually small.
Very red?
It just looks like a small, tiny, microscopic little thing.
So it's not big?
No.
Is it red?
Yes.
I can't,
no.
I can't, but
it looks like it's on fire.
I can't see a red one up there. I might be able to see a red one through here.
Yeah, it looks like it's on fire.
There are big differences between amateur astronomers and professional astronomers, and one is that we professional astronomers have gone to university to study the subject, and amateur astronomers are out there loving it and doing it and building their own thing and are happy for their independence and don't seem to mind the cold.
And their telescopes are much smaller.
That's right. Well, I don't even have a telescope, for example. What I do is I use the world's best data that I can find. And so some observer goes out and makes some very, very difficult measurements on the world's best instruments. They report what they've seen, and then I try to take that and about 200 other pieces of data, combine it to try to answer a question. For example, I wrote a paper on what fraction of sun-like stars have planets around them. And there are about 6 groups around the world which are monitoring stars for planets, but no one had written a paper combining all their data, and that's what I did.
In the early days, he would go out at 9 and say, "Well, I might be back in an hour, but could be a bit longer, and I might see him the following morning, if I was lucky," because they just keep driving until they find the right spot. And you get very used to it. It just becomes common. I don't know. I mean, our first date was lying in the backyard looking at the skies. That was it. I mean, your whole life is astronomy, but I'm not interested in astronomy at all.
Stardust on the moon, what a night for love.
We went on Glenn's honeymoon with him because they were chasing, what were we chasing at that point?
Comet Hale-Bopp.
Comet Hale-Bopp, yes.
Yeah. I'm going to say I'm not obsessed, but astronomy actually determined the timing of our marriage. Well, we were planning to go over to the States to see this comet, and Sue and I were going to go, and we thought, you know, we're never going to have this much money to do this game. Why don't we turn to a honeymoon?
Yeah.
So we did.
So everybody came with you?
Yes.
Well, these guys did, yeah. And boy, was Sue relieved after the first couple of weeks when we were left on our own.
I guess I'm reminded of the epitaph of the amateur astronomers. It says, "We're not afraid of death, we've never been afraid of the dark."
Hello? Okay, coming.
"The stars are there for everyone," he said. "But they're not the same things for every person. For travellers, the stars are guides. For others, they're no more than tiny lights in the sky. For scholars, they're problems. For my businessman, they were wealth. But all these stars are silent. You, and only you, will have the stars as no one else has them. What are you trying to say? In one of those stars, I shall be living, and in one of them I'll be laughing. So when you look at the sky at night, it will be as if all the stars are laughing. You, only you, will have stars that can laugh." And he laughed again.
In Amateur Astronomers and the Night Sky, you heard from Glenn Dawes, Peter Northfield, Ken Wallace and his long-suffering wife, Leslie Wallace. Each year, these three men publish an astronomical almanac that's a boon to any amateur astronomer. We'll have details about it on our website. Among the amateurs, you also heard from legendary comet spotter Bill Bradfield and home guy Dave Gault. Also, the volunteers demonstrating at the Macquarie University Observatory. The professional among them was Charlie Lineweaver, and excerpts from The Little Prince were read by Ali Benton. The producer was Nicole Steinke, and the sound engineer was Stephen Tilley. The music was by Pimmon. And 360 is now on Facebook and Twitter, so if you tweet or you're on Facebook and would like to get updates about our program and chat to other 360 listeners, then follow us on Twitter or become a fan on Facebook. On Facebook, you'll find us by searching with the words 360 Radio National. Those are the numbers, 360. And on Twitter, just look for RN360, 360 again. I'm Brent Clough, and I hope you can join me next week with a look at what it means to live local, to really embed yourself into a small geographical area for the sake of the planet and your own sense of community. Stay tuned to ABC Radio National for more great listening coming up after the news.